package. Hope you tune in, and thanks for listening to KPFT Houston.
Ready to shake up your Tuesdays? Check out Discovered, your new fun and funky afternoon audio playground from 3 to 6 p.m. here on KPFT. Hi, I'm Elise. Join me as we jump musical timelines together, all in the name of twisting up some fresh fun inside a multitude of musical genres. The kind of music that'll keep you guessing and grooving. Come get Discovered Tuesdays, 3 to 6 p.m. here on 90.1 FM, KPFT, Houston.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Jay Williams, and I've got a little story for you. I have been listening to KPFT for so long. How long, you may ask? Well, it was back in the 1970s, and I had just gotten my first cassette recorder, and I had set it up at home, and I was listening to KPFT, and this song came on. It was Lugar Comum. It was a Brazilian-type song, but it was done by Herbie Mann, the flute player, jazz flute player. And I managed to get most of the song on a cassette tape, and I kept that cassette tape for years and years and years. And I have been listening to KPFT ever since.
Hi, this is Clint Broussard, host of Long Time Running. As a programmer, I do my best to provide you with a soundtrack to each morning as musically diverse as the city that this radio station is in. We invite you to come by and check out all the fun and, well, just a series of left turns. Every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday morning from 10:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. It's Long Time Running right here on KPFT Houston.
You are listening to KPFT Houston.
Crying looking for you. I'm crying looking for you.
Yeah, you're listening to KPFT Houston. I'm Jacqueline Batiste. The program is People of Earth. People of Earth. It is indigenous news, views, music, and also much. Yeah, this is Pacifica Radio, and we're also at Galveston 89.5 and in Huntsville 91.9 FM. KPFT.org. So here we are, KPFT. Right now, Jim Bear Jacobs and other Indigenous people lead sacred sites tours in and around the Twin Cities of Minnesota. He is a founder and convener of Healing Minnesota Stories, and he is also a member of the Stockbridge Muncie Mohican Nation in central Wisconsin. Right now, you'll hear an interview with him about all of this with Mark Helpsmeet, and this is coming to us from our own Pacifica Radio Sprouts. So we're going to go there and listen to Jim Bear Jacobs here on People of Earth.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week.
Reparations, as we are defining it here at the Council of Churches, has to be separate from charity. It is different. Charity does not require any vulnerability. It does not require any risk. And charity is dependent on a power differential. And reparations, and this is what I tell people when I speak on reparations is going to require risk. It's going to require vulnerability. And it is going to require a shifting in power differentials.
I'm Stephanie Schubert with Pacifica Network. Today on Sprouts, we hear Mark Helpsme of Northern Spirit Radio speaking with Jim Bear Jacobs about sacred sites, tours, and Native healing. Here is Mark Helpsme.
I first learned about Jim Bear Jacobs while reading an announcement in the Twin Cities Friends Meeting newsletter about the Sacred Sites Tours, which are led by Jim Bear and other Native Americans in the area around the Twin Cities, Minnesota. He is a founder and convener of Healing Minnesota Stories, and he's also a member of the Stockbridge Munsee Mohican Nation in central Wisconsin. Perhaps most relevant today is that Jim Bear Jacobs is currently the Director of Racial Justice for the Minnesota Council of Churches and a parish associate at the Church of All Nations Presbyterian Church. Jim, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, my pleasure.
As part of your work with Minnesota Council of Churches, I understand that you're co-director of racial justice for Minnesota Council of Churches. What does that mean? What's the job description? You have to achieve racial justice for the entire state?
Well, that's the hope. So at Minnesota Council of Churches, we are building a program centered around truth-telling, education, and ultimately reparations for Minnesota's American Indian and African American communities. Our membership at the Minnesota Council of Churches is 27 different denominations across the state of Minnesota. It represents well over a million people of the Christian faith in the state of Minnesota. And, you know, we know that Minnesota is one of the most racially disparate states to live in the country. Minnesota is routinely voted in the top on lists as best places to live. However, the caveat is that is a very good place to live if you are a white person. It is one of the worst places to live if you are a person of color. And, you know, we have the recognition that many of our denominational members are overwhelmingly white. These are historic denominations with historic congregations here in Minnesota. And, you know, those churches were around when white supremacy was built in Minnesota. And many of those initial land grabbers, slaveholders, they attended the churches here in Minnesota. And so, yeah, we are into a program and continuing to build a program that hopes to bring churches along into, I guess a good word for it is reparations ministry, to make racial justice reparations as part of the fabric of their existence.
I have been reading, following a lot of cases where people have been working on reparations. Actually, something that happened in Minnesota, someone I interviewed, I don't know what it was, 8 years ago. He's Mennonite, and as part of his heritage, he passed on a couple hundred acres of the family farm.
I think you're talking about John Stays.
It sounds right. Yeah. Is he an exceptional case, if you can name him?
Well, I know John personally. He's a friend of mine. And yeah, that has been a journey for him. Yeah, I mean, the situation is he was a co-inheritor of family land in southwestern Minnesota and has chosen to make reparations on his portion of the land that he inherited to find a way to give it back to indigenous communities in Minnesota. Yeah, and he is part of the Mennonite church and has been deeply involved in the Mennonites' own journey towards racial justice and reparations, not just in Minnesota, but his case and a number of other cases are lifted up in some of the Mennonite literature across the nation as examples of how to consider reparations.
How did that work in his case? It's far enough back in my memory that I'm having a hard time pulling it forward. How does reparations work?
Well, I think ultimately, and I'll lift up John as an example, because as you said, I think he is an exceptional example. It requires a shifting of mindset. When we at the council here announced this program we were doing, a lot of people reached out and offered examples of what they were doing that they were calling reparations. But what they were doing was charity. And reparations, as we are defining it here at the Council of Churches, has to be separate from charity. It is different. Charity does not require any vulnerability. It does not require any risk. And charity is dependent on a power differential. And reparations, and this is what I tell people when I speak on reparations, reparations is going to require risk. It's going to require vulnerability, and it is going to require a shifting in power differentials. It is a release of that power and influence and a transfer of that power into communities of color and traditionally marginalized communities. So that's one thing I speak about when I speak to churches or denominations about reparations, is that you don't get a pain-free path towards reparations. It's going to cost you something. You're going to feel it. And, you know, I grew up Christian, so I have been in various churches literally, you know, for 46 years now. And particularly for the Christian faith communities that I speak to, this is the call of the gospel. You know, if we look at Paul's letter to the Philippians in chapter 2, you know, he says, you need to adopt the very nature of Christ, who was... something, you're going to feel it. And, you know, I grew up Christian, so I have been in various churches literally, you know, for 46 years now. And particularly for the Christian faith communities that I speak to, this is the call of the gospel. You know, if we look at Paul's letter to the Philippians in chapter 2, you know, he says, you need to adopt the very nature of Christ, who was an equal with God, but didn't consider equality with God anything to be held. And he humbled himself, in a sense, he emptied himself of that power. And that is the call of the gospel. So one of the benefits of working with faith communities is, in large part, the Christian faith communities have all subscribed to a centralized belief system. You know, it's contained in their holy scriptures. And so part of what I do is I just come along and I say, well, let's look at what we already say we believe and find ways to live that out.
One of my concerns has been that out of guilt, people can give money. It might be charity, might be actually painful to the person to give it up. But my question is, will it do any good? Will it help? I actually knew someone who's part of a tribe, Eastern Wisconsin, who I worked with, and she talked about money she was getting from casinos, you know, stuff that was split amongst tribe members. Mm-hmm. Let's just say that my judgment, and I was sitting there watching how she's doing this, she was not doing good things. She ended up being a thief also and some other things. But, and I'm not generalizing this to everyone, but I'm just saying money that lands in your lap can be used for good or bad. And that can be for rich people, poor people, powerful people, weak people. There's part of me that says when I'm going to take on some pain, I really would like it to be doing some good in the world.
Sure, I see that. I see that. But also when we look at reparations as an obligation, I mean, you make your payments every month to the utility companies and to your cell phone company, and you have no qualms over how the CEOs of those companies spend your money.
Oh, I do have qualms.
Well, you have qualms, but not enough to stop paying and not enough to, you know what I'm saying? Like, when we think of this as an obligation, that there has been injustice, there has been harm, and there's an obligation to make remuneration for that. And the fact of the matter is this country was built on the genocide of indigenous people, on the theft of indigenous land, and on the stolen labor of black enslaved bodies. And there's not a faction of our country that's more than 200 years old that does not trace a significant portion of their generational wealth right back to those two things. And those benefits continue. Reparations does not necessarily simply mean you're writing a check every month. You know, as we've discussed, you know, in this case with John, it's a return of land. It's a recognition that for generations, his family benefited from the theft of land of Dakota people. And John is one who holds his faith very deeply. And, you know, he was part of my conversational circles as he was wrestling with this. And it's not like he made a rash decision and just said, oh, well, I'm just going to, here's the land, you know, but you do come to that. I hear your argument very, very often. And to me, that sounds like an argument of someone who wants to maintain a high level of control over what happens. And as I said, reparations involves risk and vulnerability. And you cannot be in high risk and vulnerable and completely in control all at the same time. You have to relinquish control.
Actually, my point is, I think reparations should be done. They must be done. But the question is, how do you do them so that they do some good as opposed to doing more harm? Because people who win the lottery very frequently end up in a worse situation because they get their money that way. There's a human nature. How did John do his situation? And I'm partly inspired by something that I found out last couple of years that one of the Quaker meetings in Philadelphia area did as part of their act of reparations. They found a way to do it, to give back to the community. And they were taking from this big money that they had saved up that they had been handed down to the Quaker meeting for generations. They said, okay, we got to cut into this. We got to give it back. How can we do it? So it's the how of doing it in a way that's actually going to be helpful. That is my question.
Yeah. And I think that comes along as part of building any reparations work. You have to do that in relationship. I mean, that's exactly what John did. He volunteered immense amounts of time to an organization called Makoche Ikichupe, which is a Dakota land recovery organization. He built those relationships and there was trust. And that's ultimately kind of what led to his act of reparations. And that's what I think what I call churches into is I'm not asking churches to simply write a check. I mean, that potentially is part of it. But what I'm asking churches is, particularly with the American Indian community, since that's where my focus is, what I'm asking them to do is completely reimagine their relationship with American Indians. Because for many denominations and churches, the only contact with American Indians is as a mission field. You're sending your youth group out to our reservations for 2 weeks every summer to, you know, hand out used clothes and paint church buildings and stuff. And that's the only contact you have with American Indians for many, many of these churches and denominations. And so what I say is, I am not interested in being your mission field anymore. American Indian people, we don't need your salvation. It's been largely ineffective. It's been harmful to American Indian people. So I'm not interested in being your mission field, but let's build a relationship where instead of you coming to me with your good news, you invite me into your worship service and you begin to hear the good news from American Indian peoples and communities. Because this experiment in this uniquely Western brand of Christianity that America is so wrapped up in, it's not sustainable. And we're seeing that churches are closing their doors every single day in this country. Once vibrant worshiping communities are barely hanging on. I forget the statistics, but an overwhelming number of churches are going to close their doors in the next decade. So clearly, something is not sustainable. And what I say is, you know, look to the American Indian people. Stop bringing your sacred stories to us and saying, well, let me tell you what this says. But instead, invite us in, ask us what these stories mean, what they have to say. I'm not interested in being a church's mission field. I'm interested in being a theologian, a preacher, a teacher. That's what interests me. And as that relationship builds, you know, you build that trust. And so maybe now you're not simply writing a check blindly and you're worrying about, is it going to do any good? You've built that relationship and you know that person or that organization's heart and the good that they want from that.
You're listening to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots. I'm Stephanie Schubert with...
Again, you're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org, and I'm Jacqueline, and I'm grateful to bring this to you from Sprouts, and it's Jim Bear Jacobs, and also talking about Sacred Sites Tour, and they'll get into that. And that's in and around the Twin Cities of Minnesota. So, and he's also a founder and convener of Healing Minnesota Stories. So we're going to go back to that with Sprouts. KPFT 90.1 FM.
On the website for Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light, the Reparation Learning Labs that happen roughly monthly, whose project are they and what do you do in a Reparation Learning Lab?
Yeah, so those are, I don't even know if they've launched yet, but they are, it's a think tank kind of thing. And this really has been the work of some of the very dedicated staff of Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light. We are seeing these programs for reparations kind of popping up across, well, certainly across the Twin Cities here in Minnesota, but with a statewide and some even a nationwide proposed focus. And so we have the Reparations Learning Labs at Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light. There's another organization that has developed a curriculum called Sacred Reckonings, which is all about moving congregations through a process to ultimately make reparations as part of their functioning ministry, as part of their budget. And so we're seeing that, and we have our own reparations work group here at the Minnesota Council of Churches that, you know, we're trying to build the process for churches to engage in the work of reparations. I think it's somewhat understandable that so much of this work is happening in Minnesota. I mean, just over 3 years ago now, the murder of George Floyd, which was such a public spectacle, you know, Minnesota became the epicenter really for racial justice work. And it is out of that murder of George Floyd that the Council of Churches, our own Truth and Reparations program, was built. And we see a lot of this work coming up now as a very considered and thought out response to what is the responsibility for white people, what is the responsibility for faith communities. Because when George Floyd took his last breath and the entire world saw it, you can't ignore the problem anymore.
And I'm in Wisconsin. I understand you're from the Stockbridge Muncie Mohican Nation, Wisconsin. You're in Minnesota now in the Twin Cities area. And, you know, Wisconsin and Minnesota have been progressive states historically.
Yeah. There are 11 tribes in Minnesota. There are 11 tribes in Wisconsin. So wherever you are in either of those states, you're probably no more than 2 hours away from an American Indian reservation. But also in our larger metropolitan areas, certainly the Twin Cities in Minnesota, Madison, Milwaukee, and Wisconsin, there are vibrant indigenous communities. And those communities are going to have organizations and people that are working for the betterment of their own communities, but also organizations and peoples that are working for the betterment of just trying to level the playing field on racial justice. And certainly colleges and universities are a great place to try to get a finger on the pulse of what's happening in the arena of racial justice. And honestly, that generation, the young people are, you know, we're seeing the visioning, we're seeing the beautiful creativity come out of those communities. And then from there, it just, you know, it requires a certain amount of listening, humility, putting aside one's own ego and just being willing to be taught and to learn. You know, in Minnesota, we have an advantage of, you know, our lieutenant governor is a Native woman, and we have Minnesota Supreme Court Justice, who's American Indian woman. So we're seeing American Indian peoples really kind of making strides into those seats of power. And I think fittingly, it is so incredibly beautiful to see that many of these positions are filled for myself as an Indigenous person, but also particularly as a man. You know, it's refreshing. It's refreshing, and it's also a time of my own interrogation, right? And I think this is just a lesson in privilege in general, whether it's white privilege or male privilege, that it's time to give voice to the powerful women in our communities. And so I think, you know, how does one get involved? How does one form those relationships? And, you know, it just requires a humility, and it requires an understanding that you are coming into these circles not because you have answers that you are offering, but because you legitimately want to learn, and you want to learn, what is my role? What role can I fulfill in making justice? And, you know, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to misstep. It's just the nature of any kind of cross-cultural relationship. You're going to misstep. And how you handle yourself in those missteps is key, because you can either get very defensive and shut off, close yourself in, or you can take your correction, you can learn from it, and hope to do better next time.
And the reason that brought me here was because I wanted to know about sacred site tours.
Yeah.
And again, you've been part of this. How long has this been going? What do you do? And who participates in this? Who are the people who are going on the tour?
So I started this 12 years ago. I started it 12 years ago because probably about 15 years ago, I went on a tour of some of the really significant Indigenous sites here in the Twin Cities. And I came away with a sense of shame because I had grown up in the Twin Cities. I had been to these sites a number of times, and I never knew the Indigenous story of these sites. And it took a Dakota man who was a friend of mine to bring me through these places to learn this story. And that sense of shame of not knowing led me into action. And so I started listening to Dakota storytellers, listen to Dakota historians, reading various books. I just felt, I mean, Mark, my home is here. I've lived here my whole life. I owe it to the Indigenous people to know their story. And, you know, I wondered, like, is this something that people would find interest in? I found it deeply fascinating. I found it very powerful to have my feet touching the earth in these places where such rich history was held, both beautiful history and deeply tragic history. And so I started asking around my Dakota friends, and I started asking permission to see if this was something that could potentially be beneficial for Dakota people, and eventually received permission from elders from the four Dakota communities in Minnesota. And so I started doing these sacred sites tours in 2011. I honestly thought that by the end of 2012, I would have exhausted the audience, and that by 2013, I would have to find something else to do with my energy. And I have never been more wrong. The interest just keeps building. We are, you know, here I am almost 13 years out from it and busier now than I've ever been. We run these tours from basically mid-April to mid-November. I mean, there are times we're doing three of them a week. Our audience is started primarily with churches and faith communities. People wanted to kind of just learn about the history of where the Indigenous history of, you know, where they are. We have had groups from every college and university campus in the Twin Cities. We've been making, in the last few years, been making entry into the medical field. We're seeing groups who are hearing about it from Georgia to Washington, Washington State. It's been written up in a couple of books. And I say this not to try to build myself up, because, I mean, Mark, I am more surprised than anyone that it is what it is. And I just feel so honored to be able to do this and lead people through this. And I mean, the feedback we're getting is that this is ground shaking for people. It's transformational. I hear from people 7 years later, let's say, I still regularly think about that experience I had.
We've been speaking with Jim Bear Jacobs. I'm pleased to know you. I appreciate you taking all this time to talk to me, Jim Bear.
Thank you, Mark. Good to talk to you.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to Mark Helpsmeet of Northern Spirit Radio speaking with Jim Bear Jacobs about sacred sites, tours, and Native healing.
Bill Miller there with praises. You're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org, People of Earth. It is Indigenous Radio. So some of you may have gone to the powwow this past weekend. There was a powwow, and it was at Traders Village, and it was a two-day weekend this past week on Saturday and Sunday. So also going on right now at this very moment in L.A., it's L.A.'s premier Native and Indigenous Film Festival, Red Nation Indigenous Film Festival 2025. It's the authentic voice of American Indian and Indigenous cinema. It takes place every year as part of the American Indian Heritage Month in Los Angeles. Red Nation is a powerful media coalition to raise awareness about the lack of inclusion of Native Indigenous women in film and television. And also at the heart of their mission is to raise awareness about the missing and murdered Indigenous women. Janelle Romero is the founder and CEO of Red Nation Festival and also Red Nation Television, the television network. Many films, many new films and some older ones are being shown there this week. For instance, Sweet Summer Powwow. It's director Daryl Dennis, and it's about a young Indigenous couple who get a break from their troubled lives when they find each other through a summer of love on the powwow circuit. And it includes in the actors list in that the late and the very great Graham Greene, who recently walked on this year. So for over two decades, Daryl Dennis has been at the forefront of Indigenous theater. Currently, The Great Salish Heist, written and directed by Daryl and featuring Graham Greene again, is playing right now in festivals and releasing all over the place in Canada. The documentary, You're No Indian, it's directed by Ryan Flynn, and its executive producers are the well-known Indigenous actors Wes Studi and Tantu Cardinal, and they share the story of tribal enrollment, the process by which an individual may lose their rights to be a member of a federally recognized tribe. This has devastated thousands of people. Here's
it
a little
was put
bit
in front of all
of
the natives that everyone would benefit from Indian gaming. It hasn't turned out that way.
Imagine spending your whole life connected to a community and then being told your entire family were no longer recognized by them.
What is tribal disenrollment?
Disenrollment is the elimination of an Indigenous person's citizenship in their tribe.
Why would anyone be disenrolled? Oh, casino money.
Casinos play the biggest role in disenrollment.
The accumulation of extreme wealth is what's driving the disenrollment.
If we are a tribe of 1,000 and the number of members is reduced in half to 500, the remaining 500 tribal members just doubled their income.
It's over money.
You're taking out every single generation.
They disenroll your ancestor, and everyone who comes behind them in the lineal descent is gone.
Disenrollment is the new genocide of Indian people.
It is corruption.
They're a bunch of vultures.
There is nothing to protect Native Americans.
Disenrollment's not a bad thing to me.
They're not disenrolled. They didn't belong to begin with.
They're counterfeit.
It's Indians doing it to Indians.
That needs to change. We'll be extinct if we keep that.
We need the people to stand up and fight.
A little takeover of the tribal office.
Yeah, so again, that was about the movie about disenrollment. And again, that's by producers Wes Studi and Tantu Cardinal. So that's one of the many, many movies, fresh movies, that are being played this very week at the Red Nation International Film Festival. Yeah. also over there is the documentary. It's a short documentary. It's the 25th anniversary of American Holocaust. When it's all over, I'll still be Indian. And its director is Janelle Romero. And it's the powerful, hard-hitting documentary reveals the link between Adolf Hitler's treatment of Jews and the U.S. government's treatment of American Indians, and depicts disturbing parallels between these two Holocausts, and explores the historical, social, and religious roots of America's own ethnic cleansing. The film also examines, through the words and experience of contemporary indigenous people, the long-term lasting effects of this ongoing destructive process and the ramifications for future indigenous people now and into the future. So here's just a little sound from that.
Indians to reservations wasn't enough for many hawkish political and military leaders. Nothing short of total annihilation of the American Indian was acceptable in their eyes. Colonel John Chivington, known as the Fighting Parson and head of the 1st Colorado Cavalry, told a gathering of church deacons, "It is simply not possible for Indians to obey or understand a treaty. To kill them is the only way we will ever have peace and quiet." Later that same year, he led 700 soldiers on a surprise raid against a peaceful band of Cheyenne who were camped along Colorado's Sand Creek. Just before the dawn attack, he told his men, "Kill them all, children as well. Nits make lice." 400 people, mostly women, children, and elders, were murdered that day as an American flag and a white flag of peace flew high over the camp's tallest teepee. As tribe after tribe was successfully depopulated, demoralized, and imprisoned on reservations, political winds shifted and extermination began to fall out of favor. Assimilation became the new byword of a concerned citizenry, and so an educational model to make Indians into imitation white men was proposed. The centerpiece of this plan was the Indian boarding school system designed by former Indian fighter Captain Richard Pratt. His motto, "Kill the Indian, save the man," was the central philosophy which destroyed Indian families and societies by sexually violating and brainwashing generations of Indian children into believing that their language, culture, clothing and their very identity was evil. In actuality, the effect of the boarding schools was far more devastating and far-reaching than its creators ever conceived. It is now recognized that the boarding school experience has affected multiple generations of Indian people with such symptoms as alcoholism, drug abuse, incest, sexual abuse, and other major dysfunctions. Almost every Indian person alive today, no matter how successful, carries the residual psychological scars of yesterday and must grapple with the question, when it's all over, will I be Indian or white?
Yeah, you're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM. Yes, I did call that, "Will I be, when it's all over, I'll still be Indian," but it's, "Will I still be Indian?" So viewers can watch this film this at Red Nation Television, at their channel, at Red Nation TV. And it's also on YouTube. And they also have what they call the Marlon Brando Award. Marlon Brando was established by the Red Nation Celebration Institute. And for what he has done for Indigenous in film.
It's since the American Indian hasn't been able to hear his voice heard, or have his voice heard, anywhere in the history of the United States, I felt that it was a marvelous opportunity for an Indian to be able to voice his opinion to 85 million people. But I don't think that people generally realize what the motion picture industry has done to the American Indian. I don't think that people generally realize what the motion picture industry has done to the American Indian. What the motion picture industry has done to the American Indian.
Yeah, again, if you may know that was the voice of the actor Marlon Brando in the Marlon Brando Award that is awarded at this Red Nation International Film Festival. Honors him, but also honors individuals who have been receiving that award over these years. And it's endorsed by Miko Brando and Rebecca Brando, and they're the ones that present that award there. So again, I was just mentioning that this is going on, and they're showing a lot of the new films that Indigenous America is presenting, new cinema, to be seen for everybody to see. And I'm sure it's just an amazing thing to go to in person and to meet a lot of really, really wonderful person. Again, all this was started by Janelle Romero, and she's no stranger to Houston, and she's also on the American Indian Genocide Museum's advisory council. So she's the one that started all that. Again, I need to mention that you're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org. You're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org. I'm Jacqueline. So with some minutes that we have, talking about movies and the many, many wonderful movies that Indigenous people are and have been making, and of course some movies that have been shown at the Sundance Film Festival as well. There's so many. So many. So, going along with that, there was that movie, it's called Rumble, and Rumble came out a few years ago, and it showcased many, many indigenous music makers of all styles, of all kinds. Really wonderful, wonderful music. A great movie it was, yeah. So with that, I'm going to play a little bit from that. And this is Link Wray from 1994, but this isn't actually from the movie. It's from 1994. You're listening to People of Earth. This is KPFT 90.1 FM, People of Earth. It is indigenous. And I want to mention that there is going to be a Good Medicine Indigenous Music Festival, and this is happening this weekend at the church, at the church. I'll get this. At the church of the... 1548 Heights, and it's the Trinity Episcopal. So now I'm getting another address also on November 15 at 6 p.m. at 1015 Holman, and then on November 14 before that, that one is at 1548 Heights. So there's going to be a lot of music, a lot of various music, good music there, and also there'll be Raven Cachon will be there as well. So she's an indigenous, well-known indigenous musician. So I'm going to go to some more music. And Asanabe. This is Asanabe.
They say that we can reconcile it. Put it in the past. They say that we can reconcile it. What if I can't? It's in my blood. It's in my blood. Oh, oh, oh. It's in my blood. Why does it feel like we're on the edge? Staring down a certain day. Why does it feel like the story ends before it starts? We were here in these fading memories, so we were here in these fleeting stories, so we were here. Let me just
with that, I have to say Chichalu until next week. So again, those Heights Boulevard 1548, that's on Friday, and Trinity Episcopal 1015 Holman for Music Festival, Indigenous Music Festival. Later on.
Thursday and Friday afternoons from 3 to 6 Central. Right this second, you are listening to KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM and kpft.org.
Hi, this is Clint Broussard, host of Long Time Running. As a programmer, I do my best to provide you with a soundtrack to each morning as musically diverse as the city that this radio station is in. We invite you to come by and check out all the fun and, well, just a series of left turns. Every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday morning from 10:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., it's Long Time Running right here on KPFT Houston.
Ready to shake up your Tuesdays? Check out Discovered, your new fun and funky afternoon audio playground from 3 to 6 p.m. here on KPFT. Hi, I'm Elise. Join me as we jump musical timelines together, all in the name of twisting up some fresh fun inside a multitude of musical genres. The kind of music that'll keep you guessing and grooving. Come get Discovered Tuesdays, 3 to 6 p.m. here on 90.1 FM, KPFT, Houston.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
If you're tuning in for Mr. McKinney's The Houston Hour, you can find it in its new home on HD2, Wednesday at noon. You can access the HD2 channel on our website, kpft.org.
Arnie here. Grab a pencil. Your checklist for 5 a.m. Turn off the alarm, pull the covers over your head, feed the baby, clock out of work, head to the drive-in for coffee and a breakfast burrito, and turn on KPFT. The Attitude with Arnie.